could I start with Canterbury, with this city, one of the most ancient and historic British cities? You've lived here for well over half your life. What is your relationship to this place?
Well, it's the first place I came to when I came to England. And so the early years of my knowledge of England was here in Canterbury, and I've worked here in various jobs. I've studied here. Although at some stage after completing my PhD, I left, first to go to Nigeria for a couple of years and then to live in London. And I think probably at that point, I assumed that that was it. My experience of Canterbury was over. But then I came to work at the university. The job came up, and I came here in the mid-1980s, which was a very difficult time for universities because so many departments were being closed down. There was quite a lot of hostility to certain disciplines as well. You know, this was the period when Mrs. Thatcher was transforming the minds of British people. So I was rather fortunate to get an academic job at that time. I came back here, my children went to school here, and I find it quite good, pleasant. I found it, I still do, both to work here as an academic, but also as a place where I could write. I come from a small town, from a small island, and I like small towns. So even though I had previous to that, for the previous 2.5, 3 years I'd lived in London, it was actually a pleasure to come back to a small town after that.
There's another theme that I'd like to bring up in connection with Canterbury, which is cricket. Canterbury is a cricket town, and I know that cricket is a sport that interests you a great deal.
Yes, although I do think I prefer more, shall we say, test-level cricket than county cricket. I'm not a great fan of county cricket. I have been to the ground a few times, but probably not as often as I would if I was a supporter of the Kent team.
There is a great deal of politics in cricket. We all know about Norman Tebbit's famous cricket test. In your novel Pilgrim's Way, you talk about the notorious comments by Tony Gregg, wasn't it, talking about making the West Indies grovel. There is politics there too, isn't there?
Yes, there is politics, but that Norman Tebbit was not about cricket. It was just him being in that cruel way that that whole group of conservative people had. There was a kind of a racist undertone to almost everything they did. In the case of Gregg, it was obviously a mistake that he regretted because it in fact just infuriated the West Indies team, which at that time was just beginning to reach its peak. So it really just gave them their final push into greatness, as it were.
And this turns up in your second novel, Pilgrim's Way, which is also set in an unnamed Canterbury, but there are so many things that are familiar from Canterbury that it's, at least I instantly recognise the city, the Tower of St George's Church and all the different landmarks. The city that you describe was not as nice as the people who lived there thought it was.
Yes, sure. To me, it was a strange town. It was quite unlike anything I had lived with before, although in some ways it was a recognisable England. Because, you know, there's a cathedral, the gardens, the river, and all this kind of thing. But I think for a young person who's a stranger, it was not a very welcoming town at all.
And your narrator, Daud, I mean, he has some horrible experiences of racism.
Well, it was probably both true at the time, in a way perhaps that is less so, although there are undercurrents of it still around. But it was also a way of showing in the consciousness of somebody who's at the receiving end of some of these assumptions and hostilities and so on, and the defense mechanisms that he develops, which is to mock, to kind of answer back in his head rather than to the face of these people that he meets, and possibly to make some comedy out of it, to respond to actions that look to diminish him by trying to turn them into a comedy. So mocking the empire was one of them.
At the end of the book, Pilgrim's Way, Daud goes into Canterbury Cathedral with Catherine, and you talk in the book about pilgrims, about this sense of departure and the journey, and I thought it was a fascinating connection.
I guess that's what I was getting at also with the title, that is to say, Canterbury is of course very well known as the destination of pilgrims to the place where Thomas à Becket was assassinated. And this has been so since the murder. But now they're more modern pilgrims, I guess, is what I was thinking of at the time, that these new arrivals are also pilgrims, but of a different kind. They're not religious pilgrims. They're pilgrims looking for safety or for fulfillment or for prosperity.
Which brings me to the subject of migration, which is really the theme that comes again and again in your novels, people leaving the home that they were secure or that they felt secure in. Not usually there's some traumatic reason for leaving it. Do you think that this is maybe the very heart of modern experience, the sense of losing a home and having to find new ways of finding yourself, I suppose, and that this is particularly strong in the experience of the migrant?
It's not a new experience in any way at all, of course. The idea of migrating to look for a better life, it's a phenomenon that is with us all the time now. But in another way, it's a phenomenon that has been with us certainly for centuries. It's just the direction of migration is now different. Think about how many millions of Europeans have migrated out of Europe into other parts of the world, North America, South America, Africa, Australia, and so on. And that has almost come to seem over the last three or so centuries as a kind of a fact of life, if you like, something natural, these huge movements. The result of it is the displacement of people, in some cases the extinction of peoples. So the only difference now, really, is that for the first time in the last 50 years or so, there have been migrations from the southern parts, from the colonized world, into Europe or into North America. And this has thrown many people in Europe into a panic. And really, it's not something that is just suddenly happening and transforming Europe. Europe has been transforming other people's societies and lives for centuries. All that's happening now is that the myth of Europe has become irresistible to people who now have the means to come to it. And in many cases, these are people who are escaping violence and war. In other words, they're looking to save their lives. They're not just simply looking out of greed or whatever. So I see it as an obligation to be hospitable to people whose lives are at risk, certainly. In that case, whatever it is that you might say about people who are looking to find jobs and so on, but there is a human obligation to offer hospitality.
I am struck again and again by the failure of many of the Europeans, the British figures in your novels, to understand even the fundaments of that, of the fact that maybe it's not just a privilege for somebody from elsewhere to come to Britain. There's a strange arrogance, isn't there, that still seems to be prevalent. I don't know whether it's better now than it was when you first started writing in the 70s and 80s, but it's quite shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it must be better in some places. I mean, like in the big cities where there are large populations now of migrant people from different parts of the world, both because they're around, they're visible, they're colleagues, workmates. But their children go to the same schools, their children perhaps even date and sometimes even marry. So there must be differences in that way that was not the case when I first came here in the late 60s. But what is disappointing is that it seems every few years there is yet another panic. There is another criminalizing narrative that appears. The press takes it on, the government takes it on, new regulations, etc., to try and stop people coming in and so on. So it seems as if we never quite escape this cycle of recurring. The target changes, maybe. So it's not any longer people from the Caribbean, it's not any longer people from the subcontinent, because they've become the government now, several of them, but it's somebody else. And the argument appears to be always the same, even if the target changes. The idea that there are people who are foreigners, strangers who are coming to somehow spoil our lives or steal things from us or something like that. And yet, the truth of it is that, of course, these people do not come empty-handed. They do not come without skills. they come when they're given an opportunity to make a contribution, and they do.
In your speech, when you received the Nobel Prize, you said, "I believe that writing also has to show what can be otherwise, what it is that the hard, domineering eye cannot see, what makes people apparently small in stature feel assured in themselves, regardless of the disdain of others." So I found it necessary to write about that as well, and to do so truthfully, so that both the ugliness and the virtue come through, and the human being appears out of the simplification and stereotype. When that works, a kind of beauty comes out of it. I was very struck by a drive that seems to lie behind that, even a moral drive in your writing.
Well, yes, I think what I'm getting at is that just because people are subjects of despising narratives doesn't mean that they care, if you see what I mean. It doesn't mean that they share that disdain. And so although powerful societies or powerful narratives might speak of Africans or Afghanis or whatever as people like this or people like that, they themselves know themselves and perhaps don't even know that they're being spoken about in that way until they come in contact with it. I know for sure that when I first came to England, many of the pejorative words used to describe me were completely new to me. I didn't know that such words existed. And wherever it was that I was then, I never ever thought that this is how I'm regarded there. It's only when you come in contact with it that you understand the fullness, the completeness, if you like, of this narrative. And I suppose that is also the reason for that kind of grip that it has on, say, British society or European society, and that it is so full and so complete, and it must be very difficult from within it to challenge it.
You've lived in Britain so many years. Are you able to write about the experience of the migrant, both from the experience of that's familiar to the British reader and that is faithful to the other narrative without compromising that?
It's what I try, but then it's us for the reader to see whether that works or not. It is, of course, possible to imagine the consciousness of somebody you are not to a certain extent and to try and evoke that and deliver that. Its strangeness still remains, which is why it's still worth doing, having another go at it and trying again and again. But yes, I suppose I have come to understand something of both the experience of the stranger, the migrant, the refugee or whatever, partly because I share some of it and partly because I've been listening to stories and so on. But also every day I hear the other side, either from the newspaper or from the TV or from the fiction, the drama, and so on. So there are ways in which you can comprehend, understand, take in the world view, if you like, that is being expressed in all of that.
You write a lot about the past becoming memory and then it becoming a myth or a story. How central is that to the way that you see your role as a writer?
For certain kinds of writing, memory is crucial. I mean, certain kinds of writing that do not necessarily depend on a genre or plot or that kind of thing. I'm not trying to say that those are not serious or important styles of writing. When you're trying to reflect on issues of belonging or ancestry, which are kind of the subject of my work, really, how does it feel to be living in one place when, you know, you are from another place and imaginatively still belong to that place as well as this place? How do these things affect life, ordinary as well as unusual? So memory is very important, both because it's what I experience. Well, we all do, of course, not just me. But it's also the kind of the tormenting dimension of that strange life, which is constantly evaluating this against that. I'm sure you're familiar with it too. Evaluating this against that and this decision against that decision, and what did I do before, what am I doing now, is why am I here, and so on. All of these are questions which have huge possibilities and ramifications and so on. That's the terrain in which I move around. And remembering is one thing. There's a difference, of course, between remembering, which is an act, which is positive, shall we say, but I mean it's actually a definite act. There is that act of trying to evoke, to bring back. And there is memory, which is irrepressible. You can't do anything about it. it doesn't go away. And these are all possibilities which are beautiful to explore for a writer.
In the story The Last Gift, you have the father who's telling his children about his stories from when he was a sailor. But you also have, I think it's in By the Sea, you have that very vivid description of memories being like a gutted shed. There's a whole world, isn't there, between this kind of self-affirming, controlled memory and these currents that torment you and that again and again in your novels seem to come up to the surface in unexpected ways.
Yes, I imagine that that is what happens to a lot of people, that that there are these things that you have to keep slapping down, as it were, because, well, they make you uncomfortable or whatever. But there are some that cannot be slapped down, there's some memories. So I'm also interested in the way that, for example, family hoard their secrets, not from other people, but from other members of the family, either because they're shaming or because sometimes just to protect, you know, the children or something like that. And how such memories can be corrupting, can be bad or dangerous for those they've been kept from, even if they've been kept from them out of love or out of kindness. I remember one particular episode. You may remember the bombings in London in 2007. There's four, I think, young men who packed explosives on their rucksack and blew themselves and other people up in various places in London, on the tube and on a bus and so on. And one of them made a video. You know, there was also a fashion for some of the suiciders to make a video before. And he made a video. I think he was the only one of that group who did, or the only video that was shown on TV anyway, in which he explained or he described very passionately why he was doing what he was doing. And one of the reasons he said he was doing this was because his parents, he was of Pakistani ancestry, and his parents had brought him up in a secular fashion because one assumed they thought that this would make it easier for him to live in the UK, to adapt. And he felt something had been stolen from him and been denied him. And as he was discovering this, and if he began to share the outrage of other people, I guess by that he meant other radical Muslims who saw the behavior of the Americans and the British and so on in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on as intolerable. And so that's what he was doing. It seems strange that you express your affiliation with others by blowing other people up, but that's what he chose to do.
And there's another side, isn't there, to that, which I found in The Last Gift with Hannah and Jamal, the two second generation, the children, that they want to be at home, don't they? They want to be British because they don't have any other home. And yet this hole in their family's history means that they don't quite fit in, but they don't know how or why either. And there's that gap, which I think also you encounter quite often with the children of Holocaust survivors whose parents left that hole in the past.
Well, interestingly enough, one of the people who wrote about The Last Gift, a journalist, I mean, an Australian woman, and she said to me that when her mother died, it was only then that they discovered the tattoo on her arm and realized that she must have been a Holocaust survivor, or at least somehow in the camps. But she had never said anything. So it's possible for people to hold on to traumatic memories like that. Now, you don't know why people hold back. In the case of The Last Gift, of course, he holds back because he had done something he's ashamed of, leaving in a way that he did. Or if you like, as Hannah, I think Anna says, he was a bigamist. He was already married. He left a wife behind.
And it's awful how her boyfriend's family then react to that with all these stereotypical ways, aren't they, about, oh, this is kind of what they do out there, isn't it?
Yes, sure. But that's why he keeps a secret.
And it seems to me that your message, I mean, it's dangerous to talk about messages with writing, but there seems to be a very clear message in that, and even in the very title, The Last Gift, that whatever you do, don't do that. Don't keep secrets. This secret that comes out is a gift, isn't it?
Yes, well, the last gift is that he reveals the secret, even though he does so after, I won't spoil it, I won't say anymore, but he does reveal the secret. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a novel. I mean, you could not reveal the secret. It had to be revealed at some point. What is it that he's been holding back? But my real suggestion is that hanging on to something which the children must have sensed, this gap that you're talking about, that that has its own way of corroding relationships or corroding even confidence.
To move maybe from the subject of migration, I loved the novel Paradise, and I read it twice, once after another, because the first time I read it, there was so much that was unfamiliar to me that I was sometimes getting lost. And so I read it again, and that's a novel that is set entirely in Africa, and the only Europeans are these occasional red-faced Germans who turn up, who really have a very marginal role in the novel. I just was completely drawn into a world that I didn't know. And I really wanted to thank you for taking me into that world, because it was an eye-opener to me.
Well, I'm glad you got to see another world. It was deliberate that I wanted to say that although the figures, the European figures, whether they're German or not, is not clear to the boy at first anyway, he does not fully understand what's going on, to suggest that people did not fully understand what was happening. Had a sense, but rumors, the hypotheses, if you like, stories, some of them mythic, some of them impossible, they can eat iron and all this kind of thing. And in some ways, they almost seem ridiculous, but frightening at the same time. So I wanted that sense. So they were marginal, but in fact, of course, their role was transforming, and it hadn't yet become clear. I wanted that moment of encounter before the full establishment of European control.
And I was intrigued that you actually draw from Swahili accounts of travels to Europe in the novel. I read that somebody had written about the fact that you're drawing from these merchants' accounts, and the Europe that they describe is fascinating. Mm.
Those are real accounts that I was able to use. There was a German anthropologist, I suppose we'd call them now, but maybe he was an ethnographer or whatever name we give it. But anyway, he actually recorded oral testimony at some very early in the 20th century. So that one was actually one of the testimonies of one of the caravan travelers, which then I read in the Swahili version, the original version, and used some of it. So at some point, if you remember in Paradise, the merchant describes how the Arab and Swahili traders set up a town in the interior and names them one after the other and so on. Well, yeah, that came from that testimony.
One of the themes of the novel is slavery, and you don't shy from talking about slavery as something that did not just come from the Europeans.
Well, I mean, one of the things that is known about that part of the world, the coast of East Africa, is the slaving activities of the coastal people, who are described as Arabs, but of course they're not. They're mixed people. Obviously, they're Indians, they're Swahilis, they're Arabs, they're others as well. And it was one of the excuses, one of the so-called moral imperatives that brought the European colonizers into that part of the world in the late 19th century. But of course, it was also a subterfuge. It was not exactly the truth. But Europe had become completely forgetful of its own past, or at least the British and the French, anyway. Completely forgetful of their slaving activities in the 18th and 19th century, and made this into a civilizing mission, and exaggerated to a great extent. So, in fact, a way of speaking about that part of the world hinged on the idea of suppressing slavery, as if it was the only thing that was going on. So the most notorious example of this is Leopold's Congo, that the reason for doing this is to suppress slavery, but in fact what the Belgians did in the Congo, at least in the early decades of that process, was to actually enslave the Africans themselves.
And another thing that comes out of the novel Paradise is the incredible complexity of societies there, which I think Europeans, when they look in the European context, you take it for granted that the Scots are different from the English, and that the Czechs are different from the Slovaks, and that the Germans are different from the Austrians. And there, you're describing all these different nuances of different peoples in East Africa. And I was beginning to realize that it's exactly the same as in Europe in that sense.
It's very important that there were these differences, because it was one of the reasons that enabled European colonialism to succeed in that part of the world. If you think of the experience, the German experience of conquest, because that's really what it was, both in what became Deutsche Ostafrika or Kenya, those two certainly, it was really conquest. The British and the Germans had to fight. But they were able to fight one group after the other, because there are so many different groups. So they didn't meet a national resistance to their activities. They could deal with one group after another, pacify this one, and indeed perhaps even use them as recruits to fight the other one. So the German experience of Deutsche Ostafrika was one war after another, really, until they lost the colony. But really, from the beginning, 1888 till 1918, those 30 or so years were constant war.
And they were presumably also turning the different groups against one another.
Well, sure, that's how it works. You know, the conquered people then become mercenaries, partly because of the prestige of the conqueror, partly that they will be paid to do this, and partly because the people they're now going to fight have probably been their lifelong enemies anyway.
And that's the subject of your recent novel, Afterlives, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. But it was also, in a way, the subject of Paradise. There I was also interested in how did they succeed? How did European colonialism succeed? And it succeeded because of the complicatedness of the people that they were colonizing. So they could use this, and they did, to their benefit. In Afterlives, it's a story of that particular historical episode, that is to say the period of the war and onwards. It goes on right up into the 60s. So in a sense, they follow on from each other in some ways, at least historically.
I understand that a member of your own family, in fact, was conscripted to fight as well with the Germans, wasn't he?
Well, he wasn't conscripted to fight, actually. He was conscripted as a carrier. Because there were no roads, the mode of conveying material was to carry it on your head, on your back or something like that. So there were thousands and thousands of carriers in both the British and the German and the Portuguese and so on and so forth. And they were usually the first victims, because they were not properly looked after. They probably didn't have shoes or whatever, you know. Anyway, we used to think of him as our grandfather, but he was really our mother's uncle. But we tend to kind of be vague about relations. Cousins become brothers and so on and so forth. And he used to tell these stories of how he was conscripted and was a carrier in the German army. But he survived. Many of them didn't. And I think he deserted pretty soon afterwards.
To come back to Paradise, the very title of the book suggests something, again, that you have in Pilgrim's Way. It suggests something transcendental, something more. And there are several moments where I was, I suppose, transported to a completely different level. For example, the moment when Yusuf suddenly sees the waterfall in this incredibly beautiful place, or the scenes with the gardener in this idyllic garden, what's effectively a prison for Yusuf. And yet there's something that's beyond it. And obviously there are references there to the Quran and to the Hebrew Bible. I was wondering, what role does this sense of transcendence play in your writing, especially in maybe in Paradise, where it's the very title, Paradise?
Well, Paradise, the very word Paradise, actually comes from an ancient Iranian language. So it's not Farsi, or at least it's a very early form of Farsi. And what it means is a walled garden, not like yours or my walled garden, but really like a royal park, which would be walled. And in it would be a recreation of what we know paradise would be like. That is to say, from descriptions in the Quran. So the flowing water, certain kinds of bushes, certain kinds of smells, bird song, etc., etc. So that's why the gardens in Paradise. So it's kind of to evoke that. And I also use descriptions of paradise, like gates of flame, for example. On earth, there is no paradise, but so there are some stories that say, yes, there is paradise on earth, but he can't be reached because the gates are made of flame. So I use all of these stories in various ways to evoke that. And people do that because of their desire for it. So the transcendence is to express, why do you make a garden that is a kind of recreation of paradise? Because you want to enjoy it now, rather than wait until you're dead. And to some extent, the stories are also a kind of a way of living paradise before you actually die. You speak about it, a vicariousness about it.
And you write with great sympathy about people's faith, about their religious belief. But it always seems to come back to the role of faith in their lives. You're not really talking generally, I think, about theology, are you? It's very much how people live their faith.
It's so central to many people, to many societies, that religion is still something potent and living. This is how stories of the world are told, if you like, through those religious narratives and so on, even if people are not always practicing religiously. But the idea of the world, how is the world, and what is right and what is not, still, I think, in many places comes via religion. If you're living in Europe, the predominant narrative is secular. The secular narrative is still deeply, profoundly informed by Christian narratives of various kinds, even if people don't go to church. So it's in that sense that religion is important, because it's still a way of understanding the world. In some places, it's still really potent and alive. In other places, it's just the narratives that continue.
And there's a tension there, isn't there? Obviously, I mean, we've just seen it very recently with the attempted assassination of Salman Rushdie, that one person's freedom is seen as another person's, I suppose, existential threat, that they go to such lengths that they will be willing to murder somebody because they've questioned their faith.
To my mind, there is nothing that can forgive or allow this outrageous attack. Partly because to attack a person for writing a book or for expressing an opinion seems to me to go backwards in terms of what we understand about sympathy and humanity and civil society and all of those things. Nothing to do with West or East or anything. But in any case, I also think that the book has been misrepresented and slandered, really. So I think this is doubly wrong. Wrong because, in any case, it should never happen that expressing an opinion should be reasons to be murdered. And secondly, especially if the account that is given of what it is that the opinion consists of is in fact untrue.
I live in the Czech Republic, which in many ways might seem a long way from the experience of British colonialism or European colonialism generally in Africa. Well, what would you say to a Czech who might say that your novels are in many ways are not relevant to their own experience?
Well, I'd say if that's what you think, then forget it. Don't bother. Go and read a magazine or something like that, or read something else that you think matters to you more. But on the other hand, we should also know that the things that we read are also part of the way in which we learn about other things, about the world. So the multiple ways in which literature engages us. First, it gives us pleasure, it gives us delight, it brings us news. It tells us about things we didn't know in ways that please us and all of this. If I read a book by a Russian writer, say, or by a Norwegian writer, I don't say to myself, well, they're nothing to do with me. It's precisely because they're nothing to do with me that I think, let me find out a little bit about this.
And one of the things that I notice again and again in your work is that you often have literary references that you show these things are something to do with me. That Chekhov, when I thought about in the cherry orchard, the loss of the past, memory, not being able to go back, it's absolutely central to what you're writing about, isn't it?
Well, I think this is the great benefit and the great beauty of literature and of reading. It doesn't belong to one particular place. It belongs to everybody. It belongs to all of us. And all of it informs us. Well, all of it, if it works, informs us. So I think when I read something, which often happens, and I think, yes, I know that. I know that kind of feeling or that kind of worry, or it's just so well done here. And I hope that whoever it is reads anything of mine will think something like, yes, that rings a bell. I share that experience in my own way.
I mean, with The Gravel Heart, there are very direct parallels with Measure for Measure, aren't there, by Shakespeare? Just as in Paradise, there are direct parallels with the story of Yusuf in the Quran.
Yeah, well, sure. Yes, you're quite right. That there is a kind of a frame, as it were. Measure for Measure provides a kind of frame to that book, Gravel Heart. And elsewhere, I mean, I guess there are various references to Shakespeare in By the Sea as well, or to Karen Blixen. But I'll leave that to you to track down.
And there is one character in By the Sea from Czechoslovakia. That's the very interesting and complex figure, Eleke.
I guess I was also thinking that colonialism was not just a phenomenon to do with Africa. You mentioned this a little earlier, that colonialism was also the GDR as a colonized state. And a lot of Eastern Europe at that time was also a colonized state. So I wanted to make that comparison to say that colonialism was not just an African phenomenon.
And I also realized from reading your work that Czechoslovakia was meddling in Africa as well, wasn't it?
We had a Czech teacher, yeah, after the revolution in Zanzibar, and because it aligned itself with the Soviet bloc and because it removed all the British personnel, then schools could not run because, for example, hospitals, etc. So we had various people sent from the GDR, from Czechoslovakia, as it then was, from China, so who played their parts.
Tell me about your Czech teacher.
Well, the difficulty was that, actually, to be honest, most of them could not speak English very well, and none of them could speak Swahili. But they knew their subjects or whatever. And it created, at times, really quite ludicrous situations where you could see their rage at being unable to explain things properly because they just didn't have enough language. And I don't know, I hope they had a reasonably happy time there, but they didn't look happy. Quite a lot of the time, they looked quite miserable.
If I could ask one last question. You brought up the subject of language. It's something that's very central to me because I sort of move between three languages all the time and I sort of sometimes things cross and get mixed up. Your novels are full of bits of Swahili and Arabic and a bit of German and all sorts of things, which I love in them. Probably puts some people off, I expect, but I think it's wonderful. And I was wondering about the role of language in your writing and actually the very fact that you're writing in English, you're not writing in Swahili.
Well, these things are as they are, but by which I mean that when I found a certain fluency in writing, it was in English. It's a result of, to some extent, being colonized by the British, of course, but I didn't know that I would have this fluency or this ability in the language, which I discovered as I was growing up. And I think it's a little bit like I always like to use a sporting metaphor to say, it's like asking a sprinter, why did you become a sprinter? You don't select becoming a sprinter. You have to have the equipment, as it were. Your body has to be capable of this. And so you get chosen, in a way.
Have your novels been translated into Swahili?
Actually, there's the first translation is going to be a translation of Paradise coming out in October. But up to now, it hasn't been. This is to do with the poverty of the publishing industry in Tanzania in particular, and also the way that the reading public, there isn't such a thing there is a kind of an interest in reading, well, probably crime, probably romantic novels, that kind of thing. But books cost such a lot of money, and people don't want to waste their money on books, you know. Except if they're for schools, etc. No doubt this will change, but at the moment, people don't read for pleasure. They read because they've set this work to read at school.
In at least one novel, you talk about returning and about the impossibility to return or the disappointment of returning. How do you feel when you go back to Zanzibar?
No, I feel good. I feel fine. And I have never had any difficulty with that. A lot of my family is still there. My brother, he lives there now. But one of the things that happens when you move to another country and you make a new life is that that becomes a very complicated new life. Children, grandchildren, wife, etc., etc. And so the decision is not just a single person's decision. You can't say, I think I'll go back to Zanzibar. It's now become a decision involving many other people. And I guess also I had such a fulfilling time being an academic and a writer here in England that I really didn't want to give that up, to go somewhere else, to go back there. It suited me fine that I could go back there for a couple of weeks here and there and recharge and come back.
Is writing, in a sense, a homecoming?
Well, there is that. The writing becomes a way of visiting and remembering, and not in a therapeutic way, but simply because these things just keep inserting themselves into my imagination.
Abdul Razak Gurnah, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
It's been a pleasure.